Welcome to Software Gone Wild, a podcast focused on all things software-defined. And today we'll delve into software-based switching, and with me is a special guest, Juho Snellman. Did I get that right, Juho?
That's right, thanks.
Thank you. From Tekla Networks, based in wonderful Zurich, Switzerland. Juho, let's start with your company. I don't think that many people know what you do.
Right, so... Well, we're a small startup, about 4 years old, and basically we do TCP optimization for mobile networks, or all kinds of wireless networks, really, but we started in mobile.
And the real reason our mutual friend Luca Gori pointed me to you is because you do all that in software, right?
Yes.
So there is no magic sauce, there is no special ASICs. It's just x86 server running your code.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a software person, so I get very distrustful of any hardware that doesn't come off the shelf.
Before we go into more details, just to tease the listeners, how much bandwidth can you push through a typical Intel server?
Well, I mean, it depends on how you define push through. If we were just doing it forwarding-wise, well, so forwarding the traffic through, we've done 40 gigs, but that's not a useful thing that our customers ever wants to do. So our actual useful optimization, it's 20 gigs in a 2U box.
And how many cores would that be?
That one is a 4-socket Xeon, with each socket having 10 cores.
A 20 gig at 40 cores, or half a gig per core?
Yeah, so, well... Unfortunately, these cores are a little bit slower than the... So if you go for the 4-socket Intels, or the 4-socket Xeons, they're not as fast as the fastest 2-socket ones. So we can easily do a gig per core.
On the fast cores?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Before we go into those details, what brought you to this company and what were you doing before that?
Well, I moved to Zurich about almost 8 years ago to work at Google. And, you know, that's a really nice place. Then a friend of mine was starting a really interesting-looking startup. And even though I'd never done network programming before, it sounded so interesting. And, you know, I was looking for the adventure. So I joined up.
So you wanted to do something different.
Yeah. And, you know, the mobile operator world is so completely different from the internet world that it's... It was a very interesting change of pace.
Okay, so yes, everyone, I guess, working with networking would agree that yes, it is a different world. But why is it so different? What's different?
Well, I mean, on a technical basis, what's different is that, of course, all the internet protocols were defined for fixed line networks. So packet loss means congestion, queuing doesn't happen, things like that. While all the radio networks, their underlying properties are almost the opposite.
So, for example, when you lose a packet, it's not because the network is congested, but because there's error or noise in the air, right?
Not even that. You usually, in a cellular network, you don't lose packets in the radio because there's so much error correction and forward error corrections, things like that going on.
So it's the other way. Even if you're congested, you don't lose anything.
Exactly. So, well, or there are two kinds of congestion. You can have, of course, backhaul congestion. There you have packet loss. But then on the radio itself, what you end up seeing is just huge amounts of queuing, right? So we've seen 30 seconds of queuing for a connection. So packets I sent 30 seconds ago are arriving to you now because there's just so much data in the pipe.
So that's obviously useless.
Yes. So that's a huge, maybe the biggest issue in usability of a cellular data connection. Another problem, so I said earlier that there wasn't packet loss in the radio. That's not quite true. What you do have is packet loss when something special happens, like you hand over to a different base station. Mm-hmm. And there are all, you know, theoretically, everything will be fine. In practice, you'll often lose everything. You'll lose a huge amount of data that's in flight. But then right afterwards, the connection will be fine again. So you cannot take this kind of a big event as a sign of, oh my God, the network is melting. We need to notice that, hang on, it came right back up and be able to react to it much faster than a fixed line.
But you lost all the data in transit, which means you have to retransmit everything.
Yes, absolutely need to retransmit it, but we should not be slowing down the connection to a crawl, you know, with an initial congestion, a congestion window of one and increasing it very, very slowly.
And then there is this huge round trip time, right?
So, well, that actually depends very much on the radio technology. So, sure, if you're on 2G, your round trip times are in the 1 second range. With the best LTE networks, it's like 25 milliseconds of RTT in the radio network. And, you know, there you can't really even be, it's indistinguishable from a consumer cable modem or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So they got down to 25 milliseconds. That's impressive.
Yeah, it's amazing. And even 3G connections, which as you move from basic 3G to HDSPA, 50 milliseconds is totally reasonable to see for the baseline latency. Of course, then once you start pushing data to that connection, the round trip times do go up.
Oh, by the way, you may know the answer to this one because we were totally baffled by this behavior. When you start pinging over probably a 3G connection, the latency is huge and then it slowly decreases.
To my understanding, and I'm not a radio guy, so I'm coming at this all from the basically networking side, and we try to intuit what's actually happening in the radio network. But my understanding is that there's basically power saving modes in the state machine. And if there is very little traffic going on, you will be in basically a lower powered transmission envelope.
Which means that you can't push as much data and therefore you get the higher latency.
Exactly. But then once the baseband or whatever is actually controlling this node says that, oh, there is persistent traffic going on here, it will power up to a higher state. And at that point, you will get more bandwidth. That's a one good example of the... So a third property of mobile networks is that you have this massive difference in bandwidth from second to second. You can do the same... You can be doing a download, supposedly, at steady state, and the radio network is basically being the bottleneck. And 1 second, you're doing 5 megabits per second, and the next, you're doing 1 megabit per second. And likewise, this connection startup can be, you know, your SIM packet is normally taking 100 milliseconds and occasionally just randomly takes a second.
And we shouldn't forget that it's a shared medium, which means that if your neighbor starts transmitting, it slows you down.
Yeah, but even there, again, I'm speaking as a networking guy rather than a radio guy. The way they do it is surprising because the algorithms don't give everybody a fair share necessarily. So if I'm using the internet and you're using the internet, and maybe I have a tiny bit better signal quality, I might get hugely better amounts of bandwidth allocated to me by the base station because it's trying to kind of do this utilitarian, I can push more data to that guy than to the other guy, and they're both wanting to use some. So I should use the bandwidth available where it does the most good.
So instead of treating everyone equally or trying to give everyone equal service, the base station is trying to maximize the amount of data pushed through because they are charging by data transmitted.
I believe it's not that simple, that it's purely the maximized data, but it's also not give everybody a equal time slice. Of course, you will give everybody some amount of a bandwidth, for example.
Yeah. Not sure we want to know the details.
I don't know the details either. For example, it means there's this fascinating effect. So every time we try to demonstrate our system, the first thing the technical people at the operator suggest, okay, so let's take two laptops and put them side by side and plug a dongle into both of them and do a test download. You know, optimize one machine, don't optimize the other machine. And then we'll see, oh, this machine is twice as fast as the other one. We haven't even turned optimization on yet. Just, you know, two machines side by side, factor of two difference in speed.
Just because there are two machines.
Exactly. It's an amazingly variable environment.
How well does TCP play with that?
Well, TCP, especially in its classic forms, plays horribly. So one problem is that you get these random freezes. Nothing, you know, connection is going fine, then suddenly nothing happens for a second. And the retransmission algorithm will think that everything has been lost, and it will trigger a retransmission timeout, and in the worst case, even two retransmission timeouts. And if TCP timestamps aren't on, then they still, in many parts of the world, aren't on by default if you have a places where Windows XP is used a lot, for example. Once that data gets ACK'd, the server, that any of that data that was still in flight gets ACK'd, the server will think, oh, that retransmitted packet was just acknowledged. I have lost everything.
It will retransmit again, right?
Well, it will. Most importantly, it will slow down to an absolute crawl. So just the retransmission timeout being triggered in basic TCP algorithms will cause the congestion window to go to one. And in a mobile network, especially a slower 3G network, you cannot recover from that because every round trip will increase your congestion window so slowly.
So theoretically, you can recover, but it's a very slow recovery.
Exactly, indeed.
Yeah. So how are you solving these problems?
Okay, so what we have is a TCP proxy that is usually installed on the GI link next to the GGSN.
Okay. Don't throw acronyms at me, sorry.
All right, yeah, fair enough. So the GGSN is basically the mobile network gateway. So what it does, it gets IP on one side, encapsulates it into UDP for transmitting to the base stations, and basically routes the traffic to the right. Oh, this user, or we have a packet coming in for this user, that user's traffic should be sent over there.
So it's a gateway between traditional IP network and some weird overlay stuff that they use for whatever they use it.
Yeah, so it's basically used for the routing.
Yeah.
And yeah, we don't want to speak this. So this encapsulation is called GTP. And we don't particularly want to talk that protocol. So we go onto the last link where traffic is still normal TCP.
And you insert yourself into the traffic path.
Yeah, so we're basically a completely transparent bump in the wire. Traffic comes in on one link, goes out the other link. But then what we can do is observe the TCP handshake going through. So we'll see a SYN packet coming in, and then sometime later a SYN ACK coming in, and finally the ACK packet coming in. And at that time, we first of all know that it is a connection that's symmetrically going through our node.
Ah, what happens if the traffic flow is asymmetric?
Well, then we don't see both parts of the handshake, and we can just, any further traffic for that TCP flow will just be passed through.
So you're saying, well, there's nothing I can do because I don't see both ends, so whatever I see, I'll pass it on because I don't want to break things.
Exactly. So it's surprisingly often we have found places where there is no absolute guarantee that traffic will be routed symmetrically because there might be, multiple of these GGSNs around, for example, mm-hmm. or multiple internet links, and the only place where we're allowed to be integrated is one of those inet links.
Yeah, if you have two upstream providers and you are sitting on one uplink.
Yeah, I mean, 99.99% of the time you're fine and the traffic will be symmetrically routed. But then there is always that oddball path somewhere. And, the rule number one has to be you don't break any traffic because mobile operators are very conservative about that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so yeah, what we do is we observe the handshake and we see, okay, this is a connection we can optimize. And we have our custom TCP stack running in userland that sees all of these packets. And, it's speaking standard TCP towards the internet side, so using the normal algorithms. But then towards the mobile side, it's using various customizations to basically take into account whatever is specific about this kind of mobile technology, or even whatever is specific to this particular radio vendor, because some of them have very interesting bugs that other vendors don't have.
So you're even doing bug avoidance.
We think of it as performance tuning, so...
Okay, that's diplomatic.
No, it's, they're not really bugs as such, but there are odd things that will happen only in vendor access networks and not in anybody else's. And then it's very useful for us to know that, okay, this is what the ideal TCP stack would do in this situation. And we can do it because we know to expect this oddity. So basically, we acknowledge the packets that are coming from the, well, from either side. Any data packets, we acknowledge to them. And then we take responsibility for the end-to-end delivery of that packet. So the server, for example, sends us the first packet of the response. We'll acknowledge it, and then we'll send it immediately to the client. And then the server doesn't need to worry anymore about this packet being lost or something odd happening. We've shielded it from the radio network, essentially.
So you are running sort of, not exactly, but sort of application-level proxy. You terminate one TCP session, you sort of handle the other side as a different TCP session. Not exactly, but...
Yeah, so, well, no, I mean, it's close. TCP proxies aren't an idea we came up with. It's an old one. But the one thing I'd like to... So we don't terminate the connections. We essentially semi-terminate them. So we let the handshake go through without any changes. So the SYN and the SYNACK are just passed through. And only after that do we take over the connection. So we're transparent to all the TCP options and to the sequence numbers, which is it's kind of a useful property because you can do things like at any time stop optimizing a connection. Mm-hmm. And the endpoints actually agree on the state.
Yeah, and if you have some ICMP error messages, the sequence numbers will be correct when you look at them with the Wireshark, for example.
Yeah, it's, so we used to do things like, well, let's at least change the IP ID of everything. And then somebody at an operator asked, so why do you do this? Because I would actually like to see in Wireshark that the IP IDs match on the client and the server. And we said, Actually, there is no reason we should not be transparent on this field as well.
Yeah, the more fields you mess up, the harder it is to troubleshoot.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, once I was troubleshooting a problem with someone who was probably behind a product from one of your competitors, and when the ICMP error message came back, because the session timed out and the firewall lost state and so on, it had a sequence number in the embedded TCP header that was not used anywhere in the session.
Yeah.
So it was like, yeah, thank you, guys. That's really helpful. Okay. So if we go deeper into what you're doing, you said you're not using any special hardware.
Yeah. So what we do is we run on standard Intel hardware, usually HPs, but if a operator says that we've got a contract from Dell and we only use Dell hardware, then that's fine as well. And we use Intel-based NICs, so 82599s. And I said we don't use special hardware. There's no special programmability in the hardware. We do use bypass cards from Silicom, which are, so basically they can do electrical or optical bypass depending on the connection type. So it's, you know, very nice if our software ever fails.
Yeah, you have to get out because you are in the forwarding path.
Yeah, exactly. And because we're not a router, we used to be a router, but that's another story. We need some other way of making sure that traffic continues flowing.
So if you ever crash, worry probably some watchdog timer expires and you're shut off from the network.
Exactly. Or even if there's a hardware fault and the power supply, both power supplies fail at the same time, doesn't matter, the optical bypass will just take over. Mm-hmm. So that's a really nice feature for generating or getting fail safety for kind of little engineering effort.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it wouldn't be wise not to have that.
Yeah. I mean, you can always come up with some other way. You can try
complex.
To make sure, okay, well, you know, maybe you tell the operator that we support IPSLA, or you should do IPSLA. If we crash the IPSLA, packets will no longer be going through.
Oh, and then or run spanning tree over us, and if the BPDUs are not coming through.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's what we kind of started with. But first of all, you often have very funky equipment that they, you know, they have a GGSN and a internet gateway from completely different vendors, and the routing capabilities of the GGSN are maybe not that good.
And they hate RIP.
Yeah, so the best option appeared to be to use BFD until we looked into the documentation of the GGSN, and apparently getting BFD on that model involved copy-pasting from a Word document half a page of JavaScript into the CLI of the system.
No.
Yeah, nobody knew. Okay, what does this do? We don't know. Let's find another option.
Yeah, I mean, that's horrible. JavaScript.
Apparently, that's how it was configured.
Or was BFD implemented as a JavaScript?
Yeah, I don't think so. But yeah, just absolutely amazing stuff sometimes. So the simplicity is really nice. And if anybody is doing, I mean, obviously you should not do a product like this, but if anybody is doing networking products in general that go to mobile operators and you're still starting up, I really recommend this approach.
So the message is be prepared for everything and you'll still be surprised. So I guess, like everyone else, you're running Linux on that box, right?
Yeah, so we use CentOS, but we don't really use it for any of the networking. So
you're not using TCP stack in the Linux kernel?
No. So I mean, the Linux TCP stack, it's great for throughput. It's not really great for mobile, and it's not really great for lots of connections. So to mobile operators, it's really important to be able to say, we can support 5 million connections or 10 million connections.
Yeah, that's hard to do in kernel.
Yeah, so you basically have no option but to have some kind of user-space TCP stack.
But can you get one, or did you implement it from scratch?
So, well, you can get plenty of user-space TCP stacks, but they're always going to be special purpose in some way. So the ones you're most likely to be able to get are, for example, meant for finance. Mm-hmm. So it's all about the low latency. Get the packet to the application as quickly as possible. Or you could try to port some existing TCP stack onto using some kind of user space packet access library.
Like pfRing, right?
Yeah, or DPDK or some alternative like that. So nothing says that you couldn't take the deep, let's say, NetBSD TCP stack and just essentially plug in, okay, this is where packets come in, that's how packets are written out. But the thing for us is that because we're not terminating the connections, no existing TCP stack would actually be able to essentially be dealing with these two flows that are kind of but not totally linked together.
Mm-hmm. Because usually a TCP stack would expect to terminate the connection, right?
Exactly. So then our option would be to terminate the connections, but then we would lose all these nice transparency features.
Yeah, you would have to renegotiate the connection on the other end. Sequence numbers would be totally off and so on.
Exactly. So that's like the fundamental reason why we had to write something completely from scratch rather than, you know, let's take a existing TCP stack and make it more mobile aware.
You had to start from scratch then. How hard is it?
It's really easy to write a TCP stack that can, you know, load the front page of Google.
Okay.
You know, I have...
I sense some hesitation there.
Well, no. So, I mean, I have written multiple TCP stacks right now or by now because there's always a need to write something for testing and so on. And you could write one in a day. No problem. The problem is that there's a lot of other people who have written their own TCP stack in a day.
Okay.
And all these things have amazing amounts of bugs. And a lot of this, you know, there's this folklore. Everybody knows that zero windows are bad. Most people don't know why zero window advertisements are bad, but it's a common enough knowledge that people at operators will ask, so what do you do when your buffer is full? Do you advertise a zero window? Or there's a certain way you need to order and pad TCP options, even though the standard doesn't mandate it. There's so much broken hardware around. I say hardware because I suspect that many of these are hardware-based implementations.
Like firewalls that cannot deal with things if they don't match their existing hardware forwarding structures, right?
Yeah, so well, for example, firewalls that require that a certain TCP option, if it exists, is not the first option. And the only way you can get, the only way you can get this right is to basically say, I will do the same thing as Linux does, or I will do the same thing as Windows does, because then you're safe.
So I will emulate the behavior of someone who is common enough that everyone had to fix their bugs as compared to that implementation.
Exactly. But then there are places where you want to be, you have a good reason to do something different. So, you know, the exact ordering of TCP options in the header, nobody cares about that. So you might as well just copy other people because it gives you a little bit more reliability. Mm-hmm. So one thing we ran into recently was that we want to retransmit the SYN and SYNACK packets faster before we don't get a response quickly enough. Mm-hmm. And that's worked fine for a pretty long time. And then suddenly we had a error report from one operator, and we tracked it down to there being some kind of a load balancer in Australia.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that blog post that you wrote.
Yeah, sorry, I don't know if I should retell the story here then.
Do go on, please, of course.
Well, no, I mean, people can just read it.
Nah, it's more fun listen to it, you know, the campfire stories.
Yeah, okay, so basically what happened was there was a load balancer somewhere. If it saw a duplicate SYN, it would break the connection in amusing ways. And this would only happen if there was a high enough latency between the sender and that load balancer. Actually, not even that load balancer, to whatever thing that the load balancer was forwarding to. So what we had, as far as I could tell, was that we had a packet being sent from Europe to Australia and from Australia to the US.
Through the load balancer in Australia.
Yes, exactly.
That makes perfect sense.
Well, it was, I think, a company's, you know, they were forwarding all of their software as a service applications through some server of their own, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, that does wonders for performance.
Yeah. But yeah, so it happened that if you access this server through our software from Europe, it would not work. If you accessed it from Asia or from Australia, it would have worked. If you didn't go through our software, it would also work because that retransmitted SYN was not there and the load balancer was not confused by us.
Jesus.
And, you know, these are always very hard things to, you know, what do you do about this?
Well, to start with, how do you troubleshoot that?
Well, I mean, we take traces from a bunch of different parts in the network. So in this case, from the client and from our node in the operator's packet core. Unfortunately, we couldn't get traces from the server side, of course, because it wasn't under our control. But yeah, we took a bunch of traces of working and non-working connections and tried to find a pattern. And then finally it was, oh, hang on, there's a SYN retransmit here and it failed. And there's a SYN retransmit here and it failed. And there's no retransmit here, and that worked. So we were luckily just on the cusp, you know. If we got a reply back within 500 milliseconds, there was no retransmit from us, and everything worked fine. And that's what Europe, Australia, America, Australia, Europe, apparently. It takes 490 milliseconds to 510.
Ah, so with a little bit more congestion, you got problem with a slightly less congested network. It was okay.
Yeah.
Nasty.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, that hardware was completely broken anyway because in a congested network where, say, the SYNACK packet gets lost, they would have had the same problems.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, it turns out that basically everybody uses a 1 second timeout for the SYN.
So everyone is testing with that.
Yes, except that Apple has, I forget whether it was on the iPhone or on OS X. They have apparently lowered it to 700 milliseconds.
Yeah, Apple is doing a lot of interesting undocumented things.
I mean, it is a totally reasonable thing to do because you don't expect to have 1 second round trip times in the modern age. So it's...
Yeah, that's true. No, what hit me once was if you don't support range requests on an HTTP session that is serving video, it won't even start on an iPad. Of course, it's not documented anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's the life of the network engineer. You need to be able to debug things with very little information.
Exactly. So how often do things like this happen? Is this a weekly thing, or is it a weird bug every 3 months?
Every 3 months is a pretty fair guess. You know, early on, we had more bugs, but we also had fewer customers, so they were found less often. And you know, realistically, these are like one in a million cases. Usually, if there were any kind of serious bug, it would be discovered really, really quickly.
So these are really just the corner cases. It's not like we would have too many TCP bugs out there in the wild.
Yeah, but the thing is that if you're writing a TCP stack for most users, so well, here we come back to this other user space TCP stacks. Yeah, there are plenty, but if you're, for example, writing a TCP stack to work between, I don't know, the stock exchange server and your high-frequency trading platform or whatever, you know, you've got one server and one client, and you've got one network that never changes. So you will have any bugs ironed out very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
While if you need to interoperate with absolutely everything that exists, it's a much harder thing.
Another question I wanted to ask is, what you're doing applicable only to mobile operators, or could a typical enterprise network benefit from your product?
We've got a separate product for the enterprise. The enterprise is slightly different. The networks are actually crappier on the enterprise side. You will have a lot of packet loss. You will have often very bandwidth limited internet pipes at the place where you're installing. So a typical enterprise would maybe be a head office and a bunch of branch offices very far away.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got a very nice solution for that. But the behaviors are quite different from what we do for the mobile optimization.
So it uses the same software infrastructure, but it does a totally different thing.
Yeah, or you know, not totally different thing, but a very different TCP tuning and a different congestion control algorithm, things like that.
So basically, you're still doing TCP optimization, but you are tuning different things.
Yeah. So, for example, for enterprise, recovery from packet loss is a lot more important, and round trip times are not as good an indication of something going wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, there's also, to circle back to the telecoms world, so I mentioned earlier that the really big usability problem was always a buffer bloat, essentially.
Yep.
And what we do is we try to solve buffer bloat by essentially scheduling all of a single user's TCP connections together. So the normal problem why nobody will use a round-trip-based congestion control algorithm is that anybody doing that will just automatically lose to the non-RTT-aware algorithms.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a tragedy of the commons.
Yeah, it's like TCP versus UDP.
Yeah, but since we are getting all of the mobile operator's traffic, and more importantly, all of the traffic going to a single user, we can take all of these TCP flows and we can see that, okay, this user is getting this level of bandwidth right now. So we will give it fairly to all of the flows and we will try to keep the round trip time within a sensible amount. So then this means that, you know, the typical case would be watching a YouTube video or something and trying to web browse at the same time. And it's hopeless because, you know, the YouTube video will get the round trip times to 5 seconds.
Yeah, and then the web browsing doesn't go anywhere. Yeah,
exactly.
Been there, seen that.
Yeah. So what you want is to, well, I mean, you could control the throughput only, but that's still not useful. What you actually want is to make sure that the moment you have a non-batch connection, like a HTTP web page load, the moment you have something like that going on, you need to be able to give them a fair share of the bandwidth immediately rather than wait for the buffers to empty somewhere.
So you're trying to measure the round trip time and keep the buffers in your place and not somewhere else in the network where you have no control.
Exactly. And because we are pre-fetching the data from the internet to close to the mobile network, we can both shield the buffer bloat effect from the servers and then we can react quickly to these changes in bandwidth.
So you pull as much data as you think is feasible from the server.
Yeah.
And then you slowly push it to the end user.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, not as much as we think is feasible. Actually, you just want enough to always be sure that you have something to send. If you pull all of the data immediately, then what you often end up with is a situation where, well, I didn't actually manage to pull the whole file. And now I need to kind of deliver part of this file to the client before I have any window space to open up to the server. And the worst thing that can happen is that you don't get any window space to open up, and the server eventually gives up.
I think I've seen one of your competitors doing exactly that.
Yeah, so these are really subtle things.
Yeah, you need enough installed base to see this in practice, and then you optimize.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so for example, something like this buffer bloat optimization, that's not a useful thing for the enterprise at all.
True. Unless they have weird wireless.
Yeah, but even then you can't really trust there to be. So mobile operators are very nice because one part of the network is completely under their control. So it both means that you can be more aggressive about things, mm-hmm. and it also means that things are more predictable. Mm-hmm. So they will mostly use the same equipment all over the place. You know, okay, they might have two radio technologies in use. They will not have four.
Yeah.
So it's possible to actually tune things for a network. Mm-hmm.
Now, if we go back to the enterprise world, I just browsed through your website and it looks like you're mostly packaging the solution as a hardware appliance that you install somewhere.
Yep.
In the enterprise space, obviously, some people want to reduce the number of physical boxes they have on the remote sites. So is there any virtual option that I could use?
So we have run on VMs. The reason we don't advertise that is that we don't have a good story on doing really high performance or high volume VM networking right now. So actually, yeah, to circle back on technical issues, the way we do our packet I/O is we wrote our own user space driver for the Intel NICs. Mm-hmm. We didn't start off that way, but at some point it was clear that, okay, we don't have any good off-the-shelf option, actually. These people who have network cards that have a fast user space packet I/O, all of them don't work for us for one reason or another. Okay, let's take a month and write a device driver. Mm-hmm. And then a few months later, the Intel DPDK became publicly available.
It was like, damn.
It was a little bit of a damn, yeah. But you know, we've got something that works now. But the thing is that we can't do virtualization with, you know, arbitrary VMware, NSX, or whatever. They're not an Intel NIC.
Yeah, so you can't work with the paravirtual drivers.
Exactly.
What about SRIOV? So if I could give you a virtual function on a physical NIC, could you work with that?
Well, I've talked about this with Luke a few times. Mm-hmm.
Not surprisingly.
So, I mean, there's no reason why we couldn't. But it's not clear that that's a interesting virtualization option. So, and okay, maybe it is in the enterprise world, but the virtualization-based installations we've had so far, they've mainly been ones where the packet I/O is going over a virtual wire, essentially, because they've got their whole core network virtualized. Mm-hmm. So the firewall is running in a VM and the router is in a VM and we're going to be sitting in between those. There's not going to be any hardware for us to...
So you better be in a VM.
Yeah. And you know, this is where if we had used DPDK, as far as I can tell, there are pretty good virtualization options there right now.
Yes.
And you know, that was a very unfortunate accident of timing. But it was also a lot of fun to write the driver, so...
Yeah, and if you get requirements, you can always write your own driver for the paravirtual hardware.
Yeah, you could, but you know, at that point, you might as well then take the solution. Okay, fine, let's take DPDK then.
Yeah, true.
And you know, if anybody is starting in this space, that's obviously the choice they should make because, you know, okay, you'll get your Intel NICs and you'll get your Mellanox NICs and you'll get the virtualization options.
So if you would start today, you would use DPDK?
I think that would be a very natural way to start. Because, you know, and likewise, we'll have to do work whenever there's a new ASIC from Intel. It's not a lot of work, but it's still, you do need to validate the thing and reread 1,000 pages of documentation to find out if some register has moved.
Yeah, well, if nothing else, at least the documentation is available, which is more than you can say about other suppliers like Broadcom.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the reason we went with the Intel NICs. It was, okay, everything that we can possibly need is in this datasheet.
Exactly. And there's this programming guide that is like 300 pages long, and it explains everything.
Yeah, and I do wish that more people did that.
That would be great, but we'll never get there. Okay, so I don't want to keep you any longer. Let's wrap this up. Where can people find more about your solutions?
All right, so you can go to our website at techlo.net, TECLO.net.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter whether you are a service provider or a mobile operator or an enterprise, right?
No, we love to speak with everybody. Or if you're a reseller or a networking equipment manufacturer, it's always great to meet more people there.
And then I know that you write this blog that documents all the weird TCP quirks. Where can one find that?
Right, so my blog is at snellman.net, snellman.net.
And you're also active on Twitter?
Yes. Oh, I really should have written all of this down beforehand. So my Twitter handle is at Juho Snellman.
Okay, so I'll just put that in the show notes with links
Thank
to everything
you very much.
So people will be able to find you. What's the best way to contact you? So if someone wants to ask some additional questions, send you a tweet or write a comment to your blog, or what do you prefer?
Yeah, the best way is probably write an email. I'm at juho@techlo.net, but sending a PM via Twitter will also work.
Perfect. So thanks again for your time. And when you find another interesting TCP quirk, let me know, and we'll do another podcast.
All right. Thanks for having me.
And for people who just stumbled upon this podcast, I'm Ivan Pipelniak, and I'm regularly blogging at ipspace.net. And I'm always never on Twitter, but if I am, I'm hiding out there as at iOSHints. And if you want to follow this podcast, just go to podcast.ipspace.net and look around. Finally, if you need to know more about SDN, go to sdn.ipspace.net. You'll land on a page full of SDN resources, including training, blog posts, books, free webinars, sponsored webinars, product-focused webinars, and so on and so on. And if you can't decide what to do, well, just go to the menu on the top, click subscription, and buy the yearly subscription, and you'll get everything. Thanks for being with us, and we'll meet on some future podcast.